In an AARP magazine, and that set of letters is coming up more often for me now, in things that come in the mail, uninvited. But in an AARP magazine, singer Bob Dylan talked about his life on the road, his music, and true happiness. Towards the end of the interview, Dylan said, "Okay, a lot of people say there's no happiness in this life, and certainly there's no permanent happiness. I'm not exactly sure what happiness even means, to tell you the truth. I don't know if I personally could define it." The interviewer asked him if he had been touched or held by happiness in his life. Dylan replied, "We all do at certain points. But happiness, it's like water. It slips through our hands. As long as there's suffering, you can only be so happy. How can a person be happy if he has misfortune? How can a person be happy if he has misfortune? That's a good question. It's a question we all wrestle with in life, because quite frankly, misfortune happens to all of us. And Peter, in the book of 1 Peter, teaches us how to handle misfortune, the struggles and the trials of life. We won't always be happy in the backslapping, throw your head back, laugh kind of happiness that the world wants, or that sometimes people define as happiness. But we can experience deep happiness even in sorrow. The Bible calls this kind of happiness joy. We can experience joy in misfortune because our lives are wrapped up in Jesus. Now we're looking at 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 8 and 9 this morning. But to get the context, you have to go back again to verse 6. We looked at this a few weeks ago before Easter weekend. Let's read verse 6. "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, if needed, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." So Peter ends verse 7 talking about the revelation of Jesus Christ, that is, the return of Christ and his revelation before this world. We await that revelation. That's what we're waiting for when Jesus Christ comes back. We look forward to his return. But meanwhile, we live here on earth in his absence. He's not here in a physical sense, not yet. So we love him despite his absence, Peter will say as he begins verse 8. Look at verse 8. "And though you have not seen him, you love him." Talking about Jesus Christ. The New Testament writers put great stress on eyewitness accounts of Jesus. The crucifixion, the resurrection of Jesus were verified by eyewitnesses, because it is vitally important, and it was vitally important to them at the start of the Christian faith, to know that our faith is grounded in historical reality. So Christianity is not a mythical religion. Jesus is not a legendary figure. So the New Testament throughout stressed that Jesus' life, his death, his resurrection are all historically verified by eyewitnesses. That is, people who actually saw with their own eyes and experienced with their own senses what happened, and could verify that for all of us who live later. But what about all of those who have never seen Jesus? That's everyone in this room. What about all of those who have never seen Jesus? Peter is addressing all who have never physically seen Jesus in this verse. Yes, we can talk about spiritual perception, spiritual seeing, but it's not the same as physical perception. The disciple Thomas is a good illustration of that. You remember that Thomas was not in that upper room the first time after the resurrection when Jesus appeared to the disciples in the city of Jerusalem. Thomas wasn't there. And when he got back together with the disciples, what did Thomas say? He said to the others, when they were telling him all about seeing Jesus, he said, "Unless I touch him, unless I feel him, unless I see him with my eyes, put my fingers into those nails, those nail holes, unless I can do that, I will not believe." Thomas was a skeptic. He was skeptical of their testimony. So the next time that Jesus appeared to the disciples, Thomas was there in that upper room behind those closed doors. And what did Jesus do? He invited Thomas. He said, "Come, touch me. Put your hand in my side. Feel me. I am real, Thomas. I am real." Now, Thomas didn't do that. He dropped and worshiped my Lord and my God. He believed because he saw. But Jesus had these great words for Thomas and the rest of the disciples. He said, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed." That's us. That's you. That's me. Jesus blessed you for believing without seeing. Thomas, the skeptic, would not believe unless he saw. You have believed even though you have not seen. And even though we have not seen Jesus, we still love him, Peter says. This love is the word for love here in this text is the highest form of love. It's what we call agape love, after the Greek word for love. It's more than a feeling. It's a choice. It's an act of the will to love this way. And we are committed to loving Jesus even though he's absent physically. Yes, I know he's with us spiritually. But sometimes, be honest, that doesn't seem enough, does it? Sometimes it doesn't seem to be enough. Sometimes when we need him the most, he seems the most distant. There are times that we doubt. There are times that we question. These doubts, these questions that we have are part of our faith. Doubts are expressions of our longings to know him, to see him, to feel him. Our souls cry out sometimes in confusion, "Lord, where are you in all of this mess? What's happening, God? I don't understand what you are doing, Lord. I want to see you. I want to understand." And sometimes the Lord seems kind of distant in that process. And we are confused. And so we wrestle with our doubts. But as we wrestle with those questions, Jesus becomes real to us in fresh ways. And we choose to love. Choose to love him even with all of our questions. And that is faith. It's fascinating to me to see Peter writing these words, because Peter learned that lesson in a very powerful way. Peter, before Jesus was crucified, in that upper room the night before, Peter pledged that he would be absolutely faithful to Jesus. Remember? I will never desert you. I will never leave you, Jesus. And what did Jesus say? I think sadly he looked at Peter and he said, "Oh, Peter, before the cock crows, you're going to deny me. Not once, not twice, but three times." And of course, Peter did. Even with all of that bravado, even with all of that conviction, when Jesus was dying, Peter was denying. And after the resurrection, Jesus appeared to the disciples, and particularly Peter. And Jesus engaged Peter in a remarkable conversation in John 21. I know you're familiar with the story. Jesus looked at Peter with the disciples all around and he said, "Peter, do you love me? Peter, do you love me?" And Jesus used this word that is used here, the highest form of love, this agape, choosing, committed, absolutely with me, loyal love kind of word. "Do you love me, Peter?" And Peter answered. But when Peter answered and said, "Yes, I love you," in John 21, he used the lesser form of love. He used the word phileo in the Greek, which is emotional human love, flawed love. So Jesus said to him again, "Peter, Peter, do you love me?" With this loyal love, with this highest form of love. And Peter, grieved, answered him again, but once again used the lesser response, the human love. "Yes, Lord, I love you," with a human emotional love. And a third time, Jesus asked Peter, "Peter, do you love me?" But this time, Jesus changed the word. He came to Peter's level and he said, "Okay, Peter, do you love me with an human love?" And Peter said, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you," with a human love. You see, Peter had pledged his greatest love to the Lord Jesus, and then he had failed. He had blown it. He had messed up in life big time. And now when Jesus comes to him and is restoring him and asks him, "Do you love me?" Peter's not going to make those grand promises anymore. He's come to know himself too well. But he did pledge his human love for Jesus, his flawed love. Now with that as background, it is interesting to me that when Peter writes here, and he talks about how they have not seen him, but they loved him, that he uses the word for the highest form of love, that loyal love. Peter honors those he writes to who have never seen Jesus in life, but even though they have never seen him, they love Jesus with that higher form of love. When he who saw Jesus, walked with him, lived with him for 3 years, could only promise to love with the lesser form of love. He's commending all of the rest who love with a higher love, though never having had the experience that he did. See, Peter learned to love Jesus with the highest form of love. I don't think we doubt that. He didn't boldly promise it, but he learned to love Jesus with the highest form of love through all of his doubts, through all of his failures, through all of his denials, through all of his messes in life. And church tradition says that Peter was executed. He was a martyr. He was crucified, actually, for following Jesus. But Peter, according to church tradition, chose not to be crucified right side up. He chose to be crucified upside down because he said he was not worthy of the love of Jesus. He certainly learned to love Jesus with the highest form of love. And the question is, do you love Jesus? The question isn't, are you perfect? The question isn't, have you done everything right? The question isn't, have you Have you made all the right decisions in life? Have you been faithful? The question is, do you love me? And at the very least, we can respond, yes, Lord, I love you, even with my flawed love. And Peter was told by Jesus each time he answered the question, Peter, then feed my sheep. How do you love Jesus when you cannot see him? You love him by loving Jesus' people. Feed my sheep. How do you love Jesus? You love Jesus by loving people here. You love Jesus by loving those who are out in this world who are hurting. You love Jesus by loving Jesus' people. That's how you love Jesus. Feed my sheep. Care for those who need you. And that's how you love me, Jesus said. So, do you love Jesus despite his absence? Secondly, we rejoice in him despite our circumstances. Verse 8 again, though you have not seen him, you love him, and though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. Now he goes into an extended explanation of what it means to rejoice in him despite our circumstances. And Peter addressed this letter to Christians who were living as aliens in the Roman Empire. We talked about that back in verse 1 when we introduced this book. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who are chosen, and so on it goes. Peter addressed this letter to aliens, Christians who are aliens in the Roman Empire. Now, the term alien, as I pointed out when we introduced this book, was a legal term in the Roman Empire. It was actually a legal concept. It was a legal term applied to those who lived in exile from their homeland. They belonged to this homeland here, but they lived here. They were in exile from their ethnic homeland. They were aliens. They were foreigners. Foreigners or exiles did not have legal rights in the Roman Empire. They did not have legal rights. They were not protected in the Roman Empire, except within their own little subcommunities. So if you were a Jewish person and you left Judea and you lived in Greece, Asia Minor, you left behind your protected community. And now you had no legal rights, for you were an alien. Within the subcommunity, you had rights. Christians, Peter says, are the same thing. We are people who have left this world. We are citizens of heaven. And as citizens of heaven, we are foreigners here on earth. We are aliens. And the only legal protection aliens had was within their subcommunities. Now, that had very practical significance for Christians. If you were a Christian silversmith, for example, if your business was being a silversmith, and you lived in the city of Ephesus, and you were a Christian, how do you practice your business? Here's how you had to practice it. You had to belong to the Silversmith Guild. The Silversmith Guild in the city of Ephesus was largely, or partially at least, but fairly largely controlled by the government, the Roman government. And as a member of that Silversmith Guild, you were not protected in your Christian faith. You were required to make idols of the Roman gods and goddesses. You were required to make silver images of the emperor who was worshipped as God. So as a Christian, you're in this business world, this commercial world, and you're going, how do I live for Christ? If you chose not to do that, then you were kicked out of the guild and you couldn't make a living as a silversmith because you had no protected rights in the city of Ephesus. It placed Christians in a very difficult situation. Faith or career? These were the people Peter's writing to. This was their situation. They were working and living in Asia Minor, scattered around outside of the city of Ephesus, but in the towns and villages. They had chosen to follow Jesus, but it was tough to make a living doing that and still live out your Christian faith, which was not protected by the Roman Empire. When I was in Morocco, I saw Christians in the same situation because Christians are not protected. They do not have legal rights. And difficult to make a living in that region of the world as a Christian and still live out your faith. So these are the people Peter is writing to, and it's amazingly applicable to our lives increasingly here in America. For our country increasingly protects our rights within our sub-community of Christian faith, but not out there in the commercial world. Peter is writing to people in that situation, and he says, look, you never saw Jesus yourself in the past, and you don't see Jesus now. He's absent. And yet you rejoice greatly in him despite your circumstances, despite the problems you face. And the verb to rejoice meant to exult. They weren't just, you know, kind of smiley, okay, I'm a Christian. They were exulting. They were rejoicing deeply, greatly rejoicing in Jesus, even though they couldn't see him at that moment. They were struggling to make a living. They were rejoicing in Jesus. They exulted in Jesus despite their circumstances. And how could they do that? Same way we can do it in our lives today. How can we do that? We rejoice in him despite our circumstances by trusting without seeing. He says, you do not see him now, you rejoice in him greatly, but believe in him. You believe in him, and that's how you greatly rejoice. Belief in Jesus is not a one-time event. It's not something you do at one point in your life and then, okay, I'm a Christian now. Everything's cool. I got it. Got my ticket to heaven. It's not a one-time event. It is an ongoing relationship, a lifelong relationship. That's what believing is. And we too are foreigners in our own country. We are citizens of heaven, not of earth. And we too struggle with our faith in a world that is increasingly antagonistic to our faith. But we can rejoice no matter what those circumstances are, no matter what you are going through, because we trust in him without seeing him. That's faith. That's what real faith is. Real faith is not believing what we see. Real faith is believing without seeing. Everyone, by the way, on this earth ultimately lives by faith. The question is, what is your faith in? Everyone lives by faith in things they cannot see. You may feel as if you're sitting still right now. Do you feel like you're sitting still? Well, it's an illusion of incredible proportions. Planet Earth is spinning around its axis at a speed of 1,000 miles per hour. Every 24 hours, planet Earth makes a 360-degree circle around the sun. We're also flying through space at an average velocity of 67,108 miles per hour. That's 87 times faster than the speed of sound. So even on a day when you feel like you didn't get anything done, you traveled 1,599,793 miles through space. You're moving. To top all of that off, the Milky Way galaxy is spinning in a giant pinwheel at the dizzying rate of 483,000 miles per hour. We're moving. Can you get your head around all that? I can't. You look like you're sitting still to me. When was the last time you woke up and thanked God that He controls that Earth's rotation? When was the last time you even thought about it? Even atheists believe in the Earth's rotation. They can't see it. They can't feel it. But they believe it. There's evidence, scientific evidence, to examine that leads to belief. But they're still believing in what they cannot actually see and feel sitting here in Gorham, Maine. Christians, rejoice in Jesus by trusting without seeing. We believe in Him. We see evidence. It's not a faith that is without evidence. We see lots of evidence in our lives that He is real. We see evidence in the biblical record that He is real. We see evidence in the testimonies of others that He is real. There's lots of evidence, but we're still believing without seeing. Sometimes we struggle to believe with our circumstances. And in those times as Christians, we choose to believe, even when we don't feel like believing, even when we don't feel like it. We choose to believe what we cannot see, and choosing to believe what we cannot see is faith. It's the only way we can rejoice despite our circumstances. And we do rejoice, Peter writes, with a joy inexpressible. The word joy, he says, that he uses here, it's a very emotional word. It's the emotion, you can define it as the emotion of great happiness, great pleasure. Peter tells us that we can have this emotion of pleasure and happiness, but it is inexpressible and full of glory. The word full of glory is the word we get doxology from. It means an emotion that is characterized by splendor or grandeur. It is glorious. St. Peter's Basilica in Rome is incredibly splendid. The Himalayan mountains are filled with grandeur. And so is our emotion of joy. But the grandeur of joy, Peter says, is inexpressible. The word inexpressible means that the emotion defies description. We can't express this happiness. We can't even describe it to someone. It is happiness that is indescribable. You can have an emotion that is so deep and so great and so powerful, you can't express it. You can't get it out. It just doesn't come. And that is Christian joy. Christian joy is happiness that is so deep that it cannot be expressed or described. You realize that the deepest joy does not result in dancing or shouting or the wave and all of these exciting kinds of things that people do. That's not the deepest joy. It isn't even the deepest joy when we have songs that we sing with great gusto and we're rousing and exciting kinds of music. That's not the deepest joy either. The deepest joy is not described in songs or in art. The deepest Christian joy is hidden. It's hidden behind tears. It's hidden behind fears. The deepest joy is happiness in the midst of sorrow. The deepest joy is happiness you can't write about or you can't describe to someone else. You just know it deep inside your soul. It is joy inexpressible. It is indescribable joy. And we rejoice in Him despite our circumstances by trusting without seeing, with a joy that is inexpressible, to the conclusion of our faith, Peter writes in verse 9, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. Peter writes in verse 9 that we are obtaining this outcome of our faith, and that outcome is the salvation of our souls. The New International Version translates it well, receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls. The word translated obtaining or receiving means to receive back something that we earned in a sense. Something in return for what we have done. It was the word used for compensation. You get paid. Faith gives back an end result, Peter writes, an outcome. It's giving back an outcome to you. And the conclusion of our faith is the salvation of our souls. That's the outcome, the payback for faith. Well, salvation in this verse does not mean conversion. It means consummation. The outcome of your faith is not found here and now. It is in eternity. The conclusion of your faith is not on earth. And that's why Christians can stand up under the worst of persecutions, because that's not the conclusion of our faith. Not here on earth. It's in heaven. Salvation, you see, has three tenses. You've heard this perhaps before. Three tenses to salvation. We have been saved from the penalty of sin. That's past. We are being saved from the power of sin. That is present. We will be saved from the presence of sin. That is future. And Peter is talking about the future of salvation here, the future tense of salvation. The end result of our faith is glorification. Death is not a defeat for a Christian. Death is victory. The conclusion of everything we have lived for is found when we die. Or Jesus comes back first. I'd personally prefer Jesus to come back first. Wouldn't you? But, and Paul, by the way, says the same thing in 1 Corinthians 5. He said, if I had my druthers, I'd rather have Jesus come back first. But if not, to die is gain, I'll go be with him. Ultimately, our salvation is concluded when we reach heaven. Until that time, we're in process. We are being saved. We are being changed. We are being transformed. We are being remade. The restoration is in process. Now, you might feel like you're more in process some days than in other days, but it's in process. We're being changed. We're not perfect now. But one day, we will finally be restored to the person God designed us to be. Until then, we're in process. We're on the way to being restored. Story is told about a young boy whose parents had kept promising him that they would give him a beautiful car when he turned 16. They would give him this beautiful car. And he planned throughout his childhood years and his early teen years, he planned to park it in the family's barn where it could stay and be taken care of. He was looking forward to that. Only, first of all, his dad had to get rid of whatever was out in that barn under the tarp. Then he would have room for his dream car. But he wondered when that day was going to come. When would his dad get that junky car out from under the tarp and give him his new car? One evening, he heard a lot of sounds out there. He looked out, saw a light in the barn, so he went out. And as he looked through the door, he realized that the tarp was there, piled up by the door, and he got excited. Maybe Dad was trying to finally get rid of that junky car. And he looked in and he saw one of the most incredible sports cars in automotive history. It was a Corvette But not just any Corvette. It was the coveted, beautiful, powerful 1963 Corvette 327 V8 with a split window, aluminum knockoff wheels painted candy apple red. It was always there under the tarp. He thought it was the junky car. His dad looked at him and said, "Hey, grab a tool. Let's get busy. This is yours." God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are at work right now, restoring a masterpiece, and you are that masterpiece. You can rejoice with joy inexpressible and glorious, knowing that God is at work bringing about the conclusion of your faith in a total restoration. Nothing short of your ultimate transformation into the best that best can be will satisfy God. The greatest and grandest gifts will be yours one day when God is finally finished with you. Meanwhile, roll up your sleeves, grab a tool, and get to work. We're leaving in the meanwhile. Todd Skinner was one of the most respected rock climbers of his generation, but his greatest challenge was tackling Trango Tower, the world's highest cliff with a near vertical drop, located in one of the most inhospitable regions in all of the planet, northern Pakistan. When Todd went to find a sponsor for his team to climb Trango Tower, the experts told him, the sponsors said, "Forget it. A mountain that steep in that inhospitable part of the world isn't made to be climbed." Eventually, though, through a lot of planning and work, he got all of the necessary things, travel, food, jeeps, porters, permits, equipment, clothing, tents, funding for all of that. But he said the biggest challenge came when, after years of preparation and a rugged 10-day cross-country trek through the Himalayan mountains, the climbers came face to face with the largest, tallest, smoothest, steepest rock wall they had ever seen. Now, these are all experts in rock climbing. And here's how Todd described that moment. "We turned a corner, and there it was. Trango Tower rose stunningly before us. The reality hit us like a shock wave. We stopped dead in the middle of the track. No amount of bluff or bravado could hide the fact that we were all absolutely horrified." The team members had come for the challenge, but now it seemed too high, too vertical, too difficult, too tough, even for some of the best wall climbers in the world, to free climb that rock face. Todd realized there was only one way forward. In his words, they had to get on the wall, even if they weren't completely prepared. The final danger in the preparation process of an expedition, he wrote, is the tendency to postpone leaving until every question has been answered, forgetting that the mountain is the only place the answers can definitively be found. No matter how well prepared you are, how honed your climbing skills, how vast your expertise, you cannot climb the mountain if you don't get on the mountain. So Todd and his three teammates got on the wall. 60 days it took them to climb that. They reached the summit, free climbing. Despite years of preparation and training, much of what they learned about climbing the tower was only learned after they got on the wall. Friends, you don't learn to walk by faith after all your questions are answered. You can prepare forever till you're blue in the face, trying to get all your questions answered, but you won't learn faith until after you get on the wall. Now, the wall for you this week might be struggling with paying the bills, struggling with sickness, struggling with issues that you don't have answers for, but you got to get on the wall. You got to walk with Him by faith. You're climbing that wall. Faith doesn't start until you're after you're on it. And now you're climbing it. And we're learning to trust Jesus. And look, one day, we're going to reach the conclusion of that faith, that journey, the summit of our spiritual journey. Don't you look forward to that day? It'll be a great day. But get on the wall. Father, thank You for Your promises of hope and strength here and now. We live in the struggle, Lord. Sometimes we want to make sure that we've got it all figured out, that we can answer every question about You or about life or about our situation. We can understand everything before we're going to move ahead. And yet, Lord, that's not the way You work in our lives and in this world. Help us to move ahead by faith, with the questions, with the struggles, with the trials, but trusting You and rejoicing with this inner joy that no one can take away from us, that one day You will bring us to the top of that mountain and we will live forever with You. In Jesus' name, amen.